3 years ago on the liturgical calendar was also Trinity Sunday. And it was my first Trinity Sunday here at St. Mark's. And so I started off my sermon by giving the listeners a choice. I asked them if they wanted to hear a sound exposition of the doctrine of the Trinity and its essence to the Christian faith and its meaning for our lives today, or if they would rather hear a story about a time I almost got a tattoo. And for some reason that I cannot fathom, you chose to hear the story about the tattoo. So I told you about this very moving lecture that I heard my first semester of seminary on the Trinity, and how I was so inspired by that lecture that a friend of mine drew up a sketch of a Celtic Trinitarian knot that I was going to get on my arm. And spoiler alert, I ended up not getting the tattoo because I'm indecisive and kind of cheap, so I did not get the tattoo. But the good news is 2 weeks ago, I was going through boxes in the garage, and I found that sketch of the Trinitarian knot. And it is on the front of your bulletin. I persuaded Giannina, who's here today, to put the sketch on the cover. So happy Trinity Sunday to you. But truly, I am still very passionate about the doctrine of the Trinity, believe it or not. But since I imagine no one wants to hear a sermon about the Trinity in the middle of Memorial Day weekend, I'm going to move on to something else. Before I do want to stick up for the Trinity for a minute. I'll say what I value, what I see in this ancient teaching is really, if you look at it, a rich metaphor for describing how God is fundamentally a relational God. That God is, within God's own internal life, a community of love. The love between Creator, Christ, and Spirit, so the thinking goes, is so dynamic, it is so powerful, it is so abundant that it can't help but spill over into the rest of creation. Well, the 13th century German mystic Meister Eckhart put it beautifully. In the heart of the Trinity, the Father laughs and gives birth to the Son. And the Son laughs back at the Father and gives birth to the Spirit. And the whole Trinity laughs and gives birth to us. So the Trinity, I think, like any other concept in faith, like any other symbol, can do one of two things. It can bring us closer together or it can tear us apart. Take what the Apostle Paul does with this family language that he had in his letter to the church at Rome. Did you catch the family stuff when I read it? Brothers and sisters, you know, sons and daughters, heirs, children, Abba, Father, then that family talk is pretty strong here. So I think it's worth exploring what we mean when we say family of God or children of God. Because that language is pretty strong in church. I mean, we hear things in the liturgy about being the children of God or the family of God. And even in common conversation, we say things about, oh, this is my church family. And I think because we say those words so often, the meaning of those words can kind of become diluted. And maybe to the point where we forget what it means in the first place. So what does it mean to be a child of God? What does that feel like? Or what does it mean to be the family of God? Well, I think there's a story by Fred Craddock, who's a famous preacher. He told the story some years ago, and I was reminded of it last night, actually. Let me find it. And it's kind of a long one, but bear with me. I think this story points us to the heart of what it means to be a child of God. And this is Fred talking. Nettie, that was his spouse, Nettie and I had returned from Oklahoma to one of our favorite vacation spots, the Great Smoky Mountains. And we were at dinner in a restaurant out from Gatlinburg near the small community of Cosby. And we were in a rather new restaurant called the Black Bear Inn. And it was very attractive and had this excellent view of the mountains. And early in the meal, an elderly man approached our table and said, "Good evening." And I said, "Good evening." He said, "Are you on vacation?" And I said, "Yes," but under my breath, I was saying, "It's really none of your business." "Where are you from?" he asked. "We're from Oklahoma." "What do you do in Oklahoma?" And y'all know I hate that question. Under my breath, but almost audibly, I was saying, "Leave us alone, mister. We're on vacation, and I don't know who you are." And I said, though, "I'm a Christian minister." And he said, "What church?" And I said, "The Christian church." And he paused a moment and said, quite seriously, "I owe a great deal to a minister of the Christian church." And then he pulled up a chair and sat down next to our table. And I said, "Yes, have a seat." And I was thinking, who is this person? And the man said, "I grew up in these mountains. My mother was not married, and this is a long time ago, and so the whole community knew it. I was what was called an illegitimate child. And in those days, that was a shame, and I was ashamed. The reproach that fell on her, of course, fell on me. And when I went into town with her, I could see people staring at me, making guesses about who was my father. And at school, the children said just ugly things to me. And so I stayed to myself during recess, and I ate my lunch alone. And in my early teens, I began to attend a little church back in the mountains called Laurel Springs Christian Church. And it had a minister who was both kind of attractive, charismatic, and frightening. And he had this chiseled face and a heavy beard and a deep voice. And I went to hear him preach. And I don't know exactly why, but it did something for me. And however, I was afraid that since I was not welcome, I was, as they put it, an illegitimate child. So I would just go right in time for the sermon and sit in the back. And when it was over, I would dart out because I was afraid that someone would say, "What's a boy like you doing in church?" One Sunday, some people queued up in the aisle before I could dart out of there, and so I was stopped. Before I could make my way through the group, I felt this big old hand on my shoulder. A heavy hand. And it was that preacher. And I cut my eyes around and I caught a glimpse of the beard and the chin, and I knew who it was. And so I trembled in fear. And he turned his face around so he could see mine and seemed to be staring at me for a little while. And I knew what he was doing. I knew he was going to do what they always did and guess who my father was. And he said to me, "Well, boy, you're a child of..." And he paused, and I knew it was coming. I knew I would have my feelings hurt. I knew I wouldn't be able to come back to church again. And he said, "Oh, I know you, boy. You are a child of God. I see a striking resemblance." And then he swatted me on the bottom and said, "Now go out there and claim your inheritance." And I left the building a different person. In fact, that was really the beginning of my life. And Craddock says that I was so moved by the story, I had to ask him, "What's your name?" And the stranger said, "Ben Hooper." And I recalled, though vaguely, Craddock writes, that my own father talked when I was just a child about how the people of Tennessee had twice elected as governor an illegitimate child named Ben. To be a child of God is fundamentally about belonging. And it's about knowing deep, deep in your bones that you are loved. That you are loved, that you are cherished, that you belong to God and therefore are loved and are cherished beyond your wildest imaginings. That's why Paul wrote, "You didn't receive a spirit of slavery," which is shame. "You didn't receive a spirit of slavery to lead you back into fear. You received a spirit that shows that you are adopted as God's children." Being a child of God means that you have inherent dignity and worth. And no matter what others say about you, no matter what other claims the various unjust systems of the world place upon you, that nothing can change that fundamental fact that you are a child of God, that you're created in God's image, and because of that, you're valuable and worthy of respect. Paul also wrote that with this spirit, we cry, Abba, Father or Mother, that the same spirit agrees with our spirit that we are God's children, and if we are children, then we are also heirs. In other words, that we as children of God are deserving of all the inheritance that God's other children get. As it says, you know, in maybe high school diplomas, all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities thereof. Rights and privileges, yes. I mean, we should relish in that this morning and every morning that we get up, that we are God's children with rights and privileges, but also responsibilities. We are God's children. We are God's children, but not just us, not only us. We are God's children among other children, and acting like it is part of what it means to be the family of God. For as Paul wrote, so then, brothers and sisters, we have an obligation, but it's not an obligation to live just for ourselves on the basis of selfishness. Now, I think that's what it means to be God's family. That's what distinguishes God's family from all those other families. But speaking of the word family, when I hear that word in some context, I kind of squirm a little, because family talk can be kind of cheap. I mean, think about it. Think about the movies where the mafia is portrayed. You know what they call their collective unit? A family. That's not much of a family. Or think about all those characters in TV dramas who they say, you know, I did all this for my family. And that can be anyone from Walter White on Breaking Bad to J.R. Ewing in Dallas. He always did everything for his family, but it was actually for himself. It seems like 10 years ago, politicians loved to talk about family values. Remember that phrase? These just make me sick. Made my skin crawl, because generally what they meant by family values were referring to family units that resembled what they thought should be the norm. You know, families with a father and a mother and 2.5 kids. And guess what? The father was usually in charge. And even more commonly, when people talk about family, even really in a church family, one subtext of that is, I like these people, and we're a tight-knit group. Which can be good, but sometimes that means that there's not room for outsiders. And we live in this culture of increasing tribalism when, in so many insidious ways, in many spheres of our life, we just group ourselves together into groups of like-mindedness and shared interest, where it's really clear who the insiders are and who the outsiders are. And that's really what the Apostle Paul tries to do throughout his letter to the Romans. He was trying to unite two of the most desperate groups in ancient world, with the Jews and the Gentiles. And yeah, there were really substantial differences between Jews and Gentiles in that world, and there were substantial disagreements in Rome about what it meant to be the church. And there were disputes about, I don't know, how the believer should or should not adhere to the law of Moses, or whether or not they should be circumcised. And Jewish members came from a monotheistic culture, and Romans from an imperial polytheistic culture. And there were all these other differences. But yet, Paul reminded them that you are one family in Christ. You are one family in Christ. Yes, some of you were born into it. Others were adopted. But you're all children. You're all heirs of the promise. The family of God is different. Or at least it ought to be. You know, thinking about children, one story that has absolutely broken my heart this past week and really made me sick to my stomach is the story of those 1,475 migrant children who have crossed the border seeking help, seeking new life in the United States, and somehow our government managed to lose 1,475 children. And that some of those children have been sold into human trafficking. And I'm trying to wrap my mind around that. Seriously, how do you lose that many children? How do you lose one child? Because it's true that if one child who is young and blonde goes missing, it makes national news. But they can lose 1,475 brown children, and it takes years to find out what happened to them, or they don't find out at all. So I think the gospel on this day invites us to imagine, as a society, if we treated all children like our children, if we treated, better yet, all children as God's children, what would the family of this society look like if we treated children, as valuable and as beautiful? Now, of course, that's one of these big picture examples. So on a more day-to-day level, how does walking around with the filter of looking at people as a child of God change your day? I mean, try saying it as I do, sometimes through really clenched teeth. That beloved child of God. Because it changes on some level if we repeat it. It repatterns us, and hopefully it changes how we perceive that person and maybe how we treat them if we look at them as a child of God. And this can also include the person that we're looking at in the mirror if we see he, she, or they as a beloved child of God, and maybe even tell them that. How does it change the day? Well, I'll close with a really quick snippet. Last week, I went to a preaching conference in Washington, D.C., and it was absolutely incredible. I was really inspired, really moved. You'll hear lots of stories about it over the next 3 weeks. But it even included, I just have to brag about this for a moment, a procession to the White House, where I marched right behind Bishop Michael Curry, the dude who did the royal wedding. It was really, really inspirational. But out of all the sermons I heard that week, one line stands out to me this morning. And it came from the Reverend Dr. Cynthia Hale, who's this powerful preacher in the Atlanta area. And she preached on Micah 6:8. Y'all know that one. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with God. The verse we love here at St. Mark's. And she began her sermon by listing all these injustices in the world, but not as abstract injustices, as they concretely affected individual people. And urging us to act, she pounded on the pulpit. And I'll leave you with her quote. She says, "It comes down to this. Are you my brother or sister or not? Am I your sibling or not? So much depends on that answer. So may it be so."